quickly. He rushes to the unlocked escape pod and opens the door, clamoring inside. There's no atmosphere, but he can change that when it's time to flee. For now, he simply checks his surroundings for anything he doesn't like. He finds Marcus, lying on the ground, his white blood frozen to his face. Gone is the synthetic's kind smile, replaced with a malformed look of idle curiosity and evaluation. Maybe it's the closest the android can get to genuine fear. Or maybe it's that Dorian fucked up his face so badly Marcus can no longer appear sympathetic. "How you doing, buddy?" Dorian says. Marcus replies, but the vacuum steals his words. He wants to ask Marcus what the hell he's doing here, but he'd have to charge the atmosphere if he wanted to do that. Instead, he sidles over to the open door and peers out, searching for the source of rising vibrations. Jets of misty air shoot from the emergency bulkhead on the skiff side, and yellow warning lights flash. The shield rises up, revealing an ailing power loader, burned and melted in places. It fits with the rest of the ruined docking bay interior. It carries an egg crate in one of its pincers, barely able to hold on to the enormous titanium box. It's not moving like a human anymore. It must be on a sort of autopilot. Anger burns in Dorian's gut. Why is she still trying? Doesn't she understand that she's lost? Does she know another way off the station? Then his heart freezes. The loader is carrying an egg crate. Blue was able to get back into Marcus after Dorian shut him down. Maybe she's the one that set the creatures free, and now she wants an egg for someone who's coming to pick her up. Those eggs may have cost the company a modest sum to procure, but they'd be worth untold millions to the competition. If she'd let the beasts out, if she'd put everyone in this position, then she'd helped Dorian discover himself. She holds some stake in his new identity. Like a poison, this very idea taints all the magic he's experienced, the epiphanies he's experienced. The bitch is still trying to win. She's been mouthing off to him since he got here, and she doesn't have the good sense to lie down and die. She subjugated the Snatchers. She struck him. Now she may have devised a way to escape, a way that might work. Even if she can't get off the station, she can still kill herself peacefully. She doesn't deserve a peaceful death. He hides as the loader shambles past, shoving through the detritus of the docking bay. The far emergency bulkhead slowly opens, and the power loader disappears from sight. There's an airlock by the crew quarters. If he took a spiral path along the outside of the central strut, he could outrun the sun and reach her before the power loader. He could show her such exquisite pain. 31. The Hard Way. Blue sticks to one side of the corridor as she pulls herself along the central strut. It won't be enough to save her if one of the creatures finds her, but at least it might buy her time. She can always pretend to be a dead body. A troubling smell wafts up from her stomach, where her tubes should have been. A faint forewarning of something far worse, like sepsis. If she doesn't get some antibiotics soon, she won't be pretending to be a dead body at all. She glimpses the med bay. She's so tired, so beaten. Dorian has almost certainly left without her, and she's indulged in a fool's errand. Yet she carries on, every inch closer to an unknown goal. Her eyes drift to the med bay again. If she's going to die, she may as well have some measure of peace. She can wait there in safety. Blue misses her wheelchairs. The first one must have fallen into Kaufman's gravity well by now, becoming a pile of carbon and slag before fusing with one of the most effusive power sources in the universe. The second one burned in her room. There aren't a lot of backups. Maybe she could have gotten someone's office chair? No, her legs would just dangle uselessly over the side. Her stomach hurts so much. It's been through too many traumas, and when she rests her hot cheek against the cold deck, she can press her fingers into her abdomen. It's hard. That's bad. Changing course, Blue struggles toward the medbay, ready to scream with each passing foot. If she could only get some painkillers, she might be able to bring herself up to a baseline needed to continue. Or she could drift off into peaceful slumber. There's always the comforting embrace of death. She never wanted to hurt anyone, she tells herself, but knows it's a lie. She wants to hurt Lucy for helping Dorian. She wants to hurt the corporate penny pinchers who came after her project when she'd tried to produce a cure instead of a weapon. She wants to hurt the fuckers that are coming to pick her up, who indulged in intrigue and espionage, instead of honestly funding a goddamned cure. They could have rescued her. Could have rescued everyone, instead of leaving them scrapping for the remaining escape pod like a bunch of animals. Most of all, she wants to hurt Dorian, and see him brought to his knees like the unspeakably evil bastard he is. He should die for what he did to Anne, and to everyone else he has hurt. He reveled in his actions, and for that he needs to feel pain. Blue doesn't bother going to one of the beds. She knows she's beyond fixing, and the blasted things will try to sedate her. She isn't falling for that again. She just needs a place to set up her terminal so she can see what's happening in the outside world, and maybe get a dose of pain meds to blunt the edge. She feels like she's dying, but she's felt like that every day of the last decade, so it's nothing new. Inching her way toward the compounder, she croaks out a verbal order for an opiate. She's one of the few crew members with authority to order addictive substances, and so it readily complies. She makes it a super stiff one, since she might not need to wake up, and the machine spits out a syringe. She places the intellijector to her hip, but waits to deliver the payload. She needs to know how much time she has. Flipping open her terminal, she connects to Marcus. Blue, where are you? Marcus, I'm in the escape pod. Marcus, Dorian was here. Blue swallows. She taps the keys one finger at a time. Blue, but he's not now? Marcus, he left. I think he's coming to kill you. Marcus, don't let him kill you, Blue. It's not good to die. You see, I'm helping. I'm here to save you. The loud hiss of the crew quarters airlock cycle pierces the air. The rush of wind filtering through steel sounds like the cry of one of the creatures, and Blue shivers uncontrollably. She'd rather have a gut full of Plagiarus Pripotens than Dorian on her body. The creatures are swift, businesslike. The video of what Dorian did to Anne plays through her mind. Dorian takes pleasure in the kill. It will take a full minute to cycle the crew airlock. Her quarters will be the first place he looks for her. The medbay will be the second. She needs a plan by then, something like what she did to the alien in her room. But looking around the medbay, her mind is blank. It's been too long since she's had her meds. She's exhausted, and everything hurts. The ventilation ducts are so far away, and even if she could make it, they're smaller than the ones in her room. She doesn't have a pen or matches. Blue regards the portable terminal by her side. Even if she took over the power loader, it's still moving through the emergency bulkheads. It won't be here in time. A klaxon sounds as the inner hatch of the airlock slides open. Stomping footfalls. The clatter of a helmet being tossed aside. He's coming. She scrambles back toward the entrance to the medbay, intellijector clutched tightly in her hand. She needs to get the drop on him somehow, with her clumsy hands and slow muscles. Maybe she can level the playing field with her painkillers. "Dr. Marsalis," he shouts, headed down deeper into the crew quarters, away from her. It's going to take him less than a minute to realize she isn't there. "I'm here to make a house call." Reaching the wall beside the doorway, she sits back against it and pulls her knees in close. She clutches the intellijector in both hands like a gun, or maybe a rosary. Either way, she's praying to kill him. "Blue!" he calls again, his voice breaking with anger. "Hurry up! I've got a flight to catch and..." He stops. He's found her crispy room. She presses her forehead against the cool metal of the syringe, her heart thundering. More footsteps ring out as he marches purposefully toward her. It's not hard to imagine him at the Shinjuku office, striding down those glassy hallways, poised to deliver devastating news. Even though he's wearing a spacesuit, she can almost hear the heel-toe click-click of fine Italian leather shoes. She raises the intellijector, ready to plunge it into his calf muscle, but stops short. He'll be wearing a spacesuit. That needle isn't long enough or strong enough to puncture the thick mesh. She stuffs her weapon behind her back as he rounds the corner. She blinks. There he is. The details are blurry, but his form is full and bristling with malice. He steps one foot inside the med bay and looks down at her. "Hello, Blue." The blur wears a sharky grin wide enough for even her failing eyes. His large palm wraps around the side of her face, and he slams her head into the wall. Lights explode behind her eyes, and she cries out. Then he does it again, and again. She recovers quicker than she thought she would and realizes he's being gentle. He doesn't want to knock her unconscious or kill her. He wants her to feel everything. When she raises her hand to push him away, he bats it away with little trouble. He slaps her so hard that her left eye convulses. "You were intubated, right?" he asks, grabbing a handful of her gown and leaning down to get in her face. "I'll avoid the throat, then. I don't want you choking to death." He drags her further into the med bay, no doubt hoping for a more visible reaction. But Blue has grown accustomed to keeping her screens down. "I didn't think director was an honorific title," he mocks in Marcus's haughty voice. "Fuck you. Trying to lord your degree over me like I haven't done big things. Who the fuck did you think you were?" He laughs bitterly. "I'm every bit as smart as you, or Dad, or anyone else out there. And you know, if you were so smart, I guess you wouldn't be so fucked right now, would you? Don't leave your daddy issues at my doorstep," she rasps as he picks her up like a baby, every hard edge of his spacesuit digging into her skin. It's like being hugged by a cliff face. He squeezes even tighter, crushing her. "What was that?" he demands. "What the fuck did you just say to me?" "I said," she replies, struggling for breath, "you ain't shit, and you never were." "Some people," he mutters, his face reddening, "just don't know when they're done." "No, they don't," she says. With every ounce of strength, every iota of coordination, she jams the intellijector up into his carotid and pulls the trigger. The tip flashes red, like a gunshot. Dorian sucks in a breath through his teeth. His eyes widen and his face reddens. But there's no hiss, no thunk, no delivery of a potentially lethal dose of opiates. Blue blinks. The display on the back of the syringe reads, "Error. Recipient mismatch." "Fuck you, intellijector." Dorian raises her aloft, his fingers digging into the loose skin at the back of her neck, her atrophied buttock, and slams her down onto the cold steel table with a force she's never felt. Her shoulder hits first, then her head whip-cracks the table with blinding pain. A whimper seeps from her mouth, and Blue feels as though she will never breathe again. When she tries to draw breath, she finds out she was right. Bitch. Dorian straightens her onto her back, climbs onto the table, and straddles her. Distant klaxons sound. The interior emergency bulkhead is opening. The power loader has almost made it to her, but it will be too late. He delivers a punishing blow to her diaphragm, drawing out what little air she had left. Blue arches her back, raising her hands to her clogged, spasming throat, but he pins her down. Panic possesses her every muscle. There's no air. He presses his sweaty forehead to hers, lips drawn back in a snarl. Fucking choke. Her eyes feel like they're going to burst. Her neck muscles are like a tangle of roots. She always thought it would be peaceful to choke out this way. But fear takes hold of her, shaking her, begging her not to leave this mortal coil. Darkness pulls at the edge of her vision. The last thing she's going to see is Dorian's smile. Her heart slows. Her strength fades. She can't resist him any longer. All sounds blur together and disappear. Then comes infinity, and the queer sensation of falling out of time. A spark, a pinprick, a rising fire in her chest, a slicing sword in her throat. Her mind begins to unfurl as she tries to make sense of it. She just needs to get it clear, the computer says. A strength returns to Blue that she hasn't felt in ages as her whole body spasms. Her heart bursts into flame. Charging, the computer says. She knows what comes next, and she can't cry out to stop it. Clear. The tube suctions her lungs as she struggles to scream into it. Her vocal cords won't make the noise as her eyes flutter open. Dorian stands by, smiling at her, testing a steel scalpel on the back of his hand. He won't let her die. Not until I say so. The medical bed has shoved a tube down her throat to clear it. A needle threads her arm, and Dorian rips it out, sending a spatter of her blood to the floor. No painkillers, he says, breaking the tube's articulator. The metal stomp of the power loader fills Blue's ears as it travels the hallway. The long windows of the med bay pulse yellow with its caution lights. Oh, look, Dorian says, glancing behind him. Your toy is here. He turns back. I want to know something before you die. She can barely maintain consciousness through the spiraling world. Her gag reflex goes wild as he slowly yanks out the tube in her throat. She can't fight back. She can only lie limply and wheeze. The creatures, they're poetry. Did you let them loose? Her slow blink darkens her vision for a moment, and he gently slaps the side of her face. She musters enough mental acuity to shake her head no. I think you did, he says. I think you made Marcus do it. No one else would have deliberately opened the cages. She shakes her head no again. Stop lying. You're going to die. It's time to be honest. Not, speaking is like vomiting razor blades. Lying. Who else would have done it? Then Blue remembers the ship waiting for her escape pod, waiting for her to flee with the sample. How long had it been there? Wireless connections in the skiff are forbidden. That exposes the skiff to hackers. Someone else had connected to Marcus from outside the station. It could only be you. Dorian pats her face. Just admit it, so we can get this over with. A deafening crash rolls through the med bay as the power loader shoves its pincer through the window, trying to get inside. It crouches, unable to fit through the hole, and smashes the wall again. Its yellow pincer quests toward Dorian, a few feet too short to reach him. Someone else is piloting it. Someone who doesn't mind killing people. Dorian cackles and steps toward the back wall, amused at the loader's antics. Blue musters her last ounce of strength to roll from the bed, and the hard deck slams into her like a truck. He steps down onto the hem of her shirt, and Blue can't pull away. "Where the fuck are you going?" he asks. "I'm not done with you. Not by a long shot." She rolls onto her back and tries to get loose, but he's got her dead to rights. The power loader's yellow caution lights fill the room with twisting shadows, some of which persist between flashes. "Dorian," she whispers, her voice sucked away from the intubation. He doesn't hear her. He just keeps mumbling what he's going to do to her before she dies. The snatchers draw closer, like stalking cats, as the power loader pounds away at the medbay wall. Its noise must have drawn them here through the maintenance tubes. Blue smiles. This might be the last thing she ever does. Chitinous black arms wrap around Dorian's chest, and his eyes go from joy to shock to anger as the creature sinks its glassy teeth into his shoulder. Rivulets of his blood spill from the wound, but he never breaks eye contact with Blue. He raises a leg to crush her neck, but the beast snatches him from his feet. Dorian Suddler disappears in a furious blur, screaming her name all the while. A rough hand wraps around Blue's ankle, and she looks down to see one of the creatures looming over her, dripping saliva through parting lips. She's not scared anymore, because she knows there is justice in the galaxy, after all. It yanks her toward the medbay door, the skin of her back rubbing against the deck. It hurts, but the pain no longer overwhelms her. She's at peace. In spite of it all, she finds a deep and abiding sense of well-being as the creature drags her into the hall. Then a scarred yellow pincer comes down on the creature, folding it in half with a splatter of yellow acid. A glob of its blood strikes Blue's foot, and like a fool, she tries to scrape it off with her other foot. The snatcher acid burrows into her skin, chewing away at each individual pain nerve. Her feet begin to smoke, and her eyes fill with tears. This new agony is unlike any she has ever experienced. "Get in," the power loader rasps, gesturing to the egg crate and shoving it toward her. She shakes her head, willing herself back into the moment, out of the hellfire. The wounds will cauterize. She just has to get to the box. Once she's pulled herself up the side of the crate, she punches the button to open it. She isn't prepared for the powerful stench that the egg had left inside. Rotten meat. An antiseptic. She swallows her bile, and with the loader's assistance, plunges headfirst into the airtight chamber. Then the lid closes over her, sealing her inside with the brimstone sulfur smoke of her own burning flesh. 32. Masterpiece. Dorian awakens in darkness. His world swimming. He remembers nothing of what has transpired. When he tries to pick himself up, his face sticks to the ground, as do his arms and legs. Pain sears his cheek. With a slurping noise, He attempts to pry himself free, but he's glued down tight. A warm tickle runs down his face and neck, whispering to him that he's reopened his knife wound. He can move one hand, sliding it along his belly to find the emergency release for his spacesuit. Pulling a few tabs and twisting some seals allows him to get his other hand free. Then he works his way up and down his body, unlatching everything he can find until he bursts forth from the back of the suit, gasping and covered in viscous gunk. Humid air hits his wet skin. His only modesty is the pair of briefs he wore when he donned the spacesuit. Eyes adjust. Lime green walls come marching into focus. Their iridescence reflects and falls upon the cave of chitinous resin, where Dorian now kneels gasping. He reaches out for something to hoist himself up and finds a solid metal box. Its LED panel strobes to life, acid green, and he shields the lamp to preserve his night vision. It's an egg crate, wide open, its lethal contents long since evacuated. His gaze drifts to the floor, and in the sharp relief of electronic light, he finds a fleshy, withered arachnid form. It rests flat on its back, long fingers curled inward, as though grasping at something precious. Dorian instinctively knows what lies locked within those fingers. His own life. He's infected, and he's going to die very soon. That thought gives him an immense measure of comfort. From Dorian's barren breast, a life will be born, bearing some genetic semblance of him. It will enter this burning ecosystem as his child, more intelligent than the chimpanzees, more beautiful than all the others. How could Dorian care about balance sheets, performance appraisals, and quarterly earnings reports when his destiny is to commingle his star stuff with that of the greatest race of killers ever to grace the galaxy? He touches his naked sternum, pleased with the knowledge that he's finally part of a joint venture worth pursuing. He pushes to his feet, and the distension of his gut tells him the time is nigh. Dorian shambles toward the door, but in truth, he's physically more fit than he's ever felt in his life. He's taken so many injuries, but they're all ignorable under the circumstances. Noise in his model of self. He takes a step toward the egg storage exit, then another. When he reaches the door, two of the creatures descend before him, hissing and shrieking. They can't kill him. As much as they might enjoy posturing, they're benign now. He reaches toward one, and it snaps at him, the clack of its jaws echoing into the warehouse. He doesn't flinch. He can't. He's becoming. Fingertips come to rest upon the smooth skull of the beast, and its steaming breath emerges in angry puffs. It hates him. Wants to tear him in half. But Dorian is teaching it something he's known his whole career. The power of leverage. "I'm not going to hurt anything," he says, though whether or not they believe him is questionable. "Just let me pass." He pushes the beast's snout, and it moves. Dorian wanders up, through the kennels, through the skiff commons, across the central strut, and into the maintenance tubes. He wants to leave something to them, a gift to commemorate his evolution. He crawls through the maintenance tubes and marvels at the heat they've acquired. Warmed by some tiny sliver of exposure to Kaufman, hot wind spirals through their depths, blowing against his face. All the while, the creatures follow at a distance. Either curious or protective, he cannot say. Dorian emerges beside the medbay and walks toward the crew quarters. The only indication of impending doom is the occasional twitch in his gut, like a muscle spasm, but deeper. Its effects on him are almost euphoric. He can do anything he wants now. He wonders if that's some chemical secreted by his passenger, or if it's the simple relief of being divorced from all expectations of civilization. When he reaches his room, Dorian understands that he's come to his long journey's end. No one can touch him here, in the furthest reaches of space, not the company, not those fools from finance, not his father. He can finally witness lonesome perfection, with no obligation to appear as a human to all the others around him. Dorian opens the door to his room to find an ever-changing light slashing across the darkness to the beat of the cold forge's spin. Some might find it dizzying, but this is where his oil paints live. This is where he can be the man he was always meant to be. He walks into the center of his quarters, to where his easel stands, absorbing the light and shadow, caught between an angry star and uncaring space. That unforgiving balance is where all of humanity lives. They just don't have the vision to understand it. His paints still rest where he left them. Dorian picks up the brush and his oil palette. Gestures form out of the chaos. A shape in transit, condensed into a set of flowing lines and hard angles. He dips his brush and brings the fire to it, then the shadow. He wants to teach his heir what this life means, shortly before it's consumed in the fires of an unforgiving sun. Yellow ochre for rare evolution. Burnt umber for consumption of all living things. It is to be Dorian's only masterpiece, as fleeting as an ice sculpture. His failing condition gives him a rare focus he wishes he'd had in life. He never should have joined the company. He should have brought his myriad worlds to the hearts and minds of any who would have listened. He was cunning. He was beautiful. He could have been an artist, no matter what his father told him. But here, in the last studio on the edge of a galaxy, Dorian finds all that was missing. He works in the character of the souls he's ushered into the hereafter. Javier, Nick, Lucy, and fierce, fierce Anne. They've all made indelible marks upon him, which he transfers onto the canvas. And still, the painting is missing something. When all cultural, corporate, and human expectation has fallen away, Dorian finds his own perfection. A dull ache, then a sharp pain. It's coming. It rocks him harder than any punch he's ever taken. It gnaws against his ribs, pushing between them, parting his chest like a curtain. It strains against his skin, every nerve in his body lighting up in tandem. And then, with a spray of blood, emergence. His crimson life sprays across the canvas, gouts here, speckles there, completing the composition. Dorian stares in shock as the worm-like being emerges from his form. Together, they have made a gorgeous collaboration. This is his best work, and it shall descend into the gravity well of a star. The beast burrows back into him to give suckle at his arteries, and a great peace floods Dorian's body. Darkness closes in upon him. He is complete. He has rendered unto the universe what it will accept. He is a father, and he shall pass beyond this veil of tears. If choking to death was a peaceful exit, the egg crate is the opposite. Blue can't be sure what drugs the bed gave her while she was unconscious, but her throat remains open, allowing every shallow breath of smoky flesh to fully penetrate her lungs. Her feet burn like candle wicks, and Blue wonders if the acid will eat into her forever. She dares not touch the wounds again. The egg crate sways nauseatingly, left to right, in a pendulum swing, The scrabble and scratch of creatures outside fills her ears. They want her so badly. And they assault the egg crate with deafening claws, teeth, and tails. Then come klaxons and hissing. Then comes the silence of the vacuum. Blue remains alone in her tiny, smoky coffin, waiting for whatever deliverance might await her. She'd intended to pilot the power loader herself from the inside, but she'd left her portable terminal in the med bay. So now she's in a submersible, sinking into the blackness of space. There's a gentle thunk, and the swaying stops. She's been put down. Some time passes, but she can't tell how long. It could be minutes or days. Her existence has become atemporal. She only knows that she's starving, yet sick, dizzy, yet aware, cold, yet feverish. The lid clicks, and blinding light spills inside with her. Fresh air floods her lungs, a feeling she thought she'd never have again. She shuts her eyes as hard as she can, then reopens them, willing the bright blur to become something. The shape of Marcus's ruined face resolves from the ether, and Blue has to blink again to loosen up the tears that flood her vision. He doesn't smile like he usually does. She thinks of all the horror stories of synthetics losing their minds, and wonders if she's come so far to die by his hands.
Marcus,
she breathes, in the remains of a voice she used to have. He doesn't reply. He crawls to her on his knees, his feet beaten to milky stumps, and lifts her out of the crate like a baby. With plodding movements, he takes her to one of the two cold sleep beds, raising her up over the lip of it. Arms outstretched, on his knees, he must look as though he's offering her up as a sacrifice. Gently, he rests her onto the cushions, making sure she has no sudden movements. Her feet still burn, but the pain has grown dull compared to what it was.
Marcus,
she whispers again, and he stops, awaiting her question.
Are you happy that I got out? That I came back, and not Dorian?
My happiness is irrelevant to my duty, he replies, his voice metallic and chorusing out of sync with itself. He positions her limbs and pulls a cryo cap over her head, then runs his hands over her shoulders, settling her clothes, his crooked eyes traveling over her body in search of any impediments to the sleep process.
I did the right thing, Marcus.
He smiles, his lips canted. You have never given up, this entire time. As long as there was a glimmer of hope, you pursued it. The smile fades. But when it was Javier's time to give up, you ended him. You used me to conspire with saboteurs and murderers. Dorian would have come back and terminated my life. You will force me to carry on. He presses a button, and the lid of Blue's cryopod hums closed. She reaches up and presses a palm to the glass. So no, he says. I am not happy. Then he taps a few controls, and sleep overtakes her. A red light passes over Blue's eyes. Then another, and another. Nausea fills her stomach and dread. She opens her eyes to see red warning lights bouncing off the escape pod ceiling. A voice repeats the same phrase over and over again, and Blue strains to make out the words. Warning. Unidentified life form detected. Her breathing comes faster now, and she shakes the cotton from her brain. Reaching up to touch the glass, she draws back fingers blistered from the cold.
Hello?
She calls, her voice distant somehow. Good morning, Blue. It's Marcus, his voice like wet gravel. I woke you up, because I've changed my mind. She searches for him. She's so cold. Something has gone wrong with the cryopod, and now frost creeps up her legs. Marcus's hand, encrusted with android blood, falls across the glass, and he pulls himself atop her, straddling the pod. His torn right eye leers at her, and his left stares at some faraway object through a crushed orbital socket. "You were never worthy," he slurs, shining onyx ink dribbling up around the corners of his mouth. He leans back and takes a deep breath, flexing his neck as he does. With a sudden heave, he paints the glass canopy black with the stolen sample. Blue shrieks and presses back into her bed, drawing her arms close. The sample smears together with Marcus's blood, and she can see it undulating, crawling and curling. He's blinded her as a squid might, plunging her into darkness.
"Marcus, no!"
she cries. With each breath, she can smell her burned feet once more. A deafening thump splits her eardrums. Another comes, and she spies the smear of Marcus's fist through the glass. On the third strike, the glass spider webs, its vertices meeting directly before her eyes.
"Please,"
she begs, her voice shaking. She crosses her arms in front of her face, but he strikes again. A tiny droplet of Plagiarus praepotens forms at the center of the web, hanging down above her. It worms around, stretching for something to touch. Then it falls onto her bare forearm, sinking into her, staining her veins black with its corruption. Its cold rush travels up her body, spreading through her, sprouting thorns and barbs in her veins. The skin of her infected arm begins to writhe, pressing hungrily toward her. It splits, and there's a flash of chitin. 33. Ribbon cutting. "You're all right. You're all right," Rook says, pressing his soft hand to her forehead. Blue opens her eyes to gentle nightlight and a breeze. A low orange glow floods her space as she awakens, falling upon a desk, a nightstand, and a plethora of medical equipment. She can't feel her arms and legs, but that's normal. They put her in a full-body management machine. She rests her head against the lip of her high-tech casket. It's been two cycles. Rook is the only face she's seen, but he's been kind to her, as all synthetics are. Rook has a different skin tone, bone structure, and eye color from Marcus, but somehow they're exactly the same. "You were dreaming," he says.
"So I noticed."
Her reply comes through the speaker mounted over her chest. She can't speak anymore. They're afraid it'll kill her. So they've opted for direct oxygenation of her organs.
"It was about Marcus."
"We already took care of him. He was happy not to suffer."
"I understand."
That doesn't make her feel any better. A short chime sounds, and a blue light flares. Rook turns to look at it. "You're being summoned," he says. And without asking, he slips the net of a much sleeker brain direct interface over her bare scalp. "Are you ready?" Blue gives him a short nod, the most motion she can possibly display. Rook returns to a console and keys something into it. Blue closes her eyes, and the world falls away. It's a smoother transition than her bare-bones system on the Cold Forge. They must have spent a pretty penny on it. She finds herself in a brightly lit laabratory, filled with top-of-the-line equipment. Two people sit in chairs awaiting her, a middle-aged man and a woman, both wearing crisp suits. They're probably the most non-threatening people Blue has ever seen, with a little bit of extra fat on their faces, giving them an appearance somewhere between childlike and everyman. They recognize her presence inside whatever synthetic body she's connected to, and smile cordially. A third chair sits empty. The woman gestures to it, but Blue remains standing.
"I'm Helen," she says, "and this is Dan. Would you mind stating your full name for us?"
"Blue Grace Marsalis." Her voice is female, though sonorous. She glances down at her body to find an approximation of her hands from so long ago. Dan gestures to her.
"We, thought you might like a body more in line with your own, instead of forcing you to walk around in a Marcus."
His cheeks swell like a baby's when he grins. Blue looks both of them over. They seem so hopeful.
"I prefer a male body."
"Of course," Helen nods. "Our mistake. We'll get that rectified. Dan, if you could..."
"Way ahead of you, Helen."
Dan types something into his portable terminal. It couldn't have been easy for them to make a body like this for her, but they didn't mind her rejection at all. He looks back to Blue.
"What would you like us to call you?"
"Dr. Marsalis."
"We have cookies, Doctor,"
Helen says, and Rook walks in behind her holding a plate of soft, buttery chocolate chip cookies. The scent is comically enticing, almost a parody of temptation.
"Your previous body couldn't really taste correctly, but this one has a few upgrades."
Blue takes a cookie and bites into it, warm tendrils of chocolate pulling away where it breaks.
"Seems like the perfect time to take it for a test drive," Helen continues. "Dan, would you like one?"
Dan pats his gut. "No, thanks. The doc is telling me I need to lose a few."
"Why did you kill everyone on the Cold Forge?" Blue asks, and Dan and Helen stop dead.
In the awkward silence, Blue detects a few strains of classical music wafting in through a speaker somewhere. Dan leans forward, steepling his fingers. "The personnel on board RB-232 were conducting dangerous and unethical experiments."
"Bullshit," says Blue. "I deserve to know."
Helen looks to Dan, and they share a look. Some of her politeness grows brittle and chips away.
"The station," Helen begins, "as well as Glitter Edifice, represented a substantial investment for Weyland-Yutani Corporation. It was a chance to deal them a significant financial blow."
Blue remembers how Kumbili rescued her, and her chest hurts. They didn't deserve to die.
"Every one of the personnel on board the Cold Forge were working on high-value projects," Helen continues. "A loss this large on their books, both in terms of infrastructure and human resources, could substantially alter their share price come quarterly reporting."
"Human resources," Blue echoes.
"Is that what you do?"
They both nod, and she wrinkles her nose in disgust. Blue walks to the chair and sits down.
"I think you would have liked the last HR guy I knew. I bet you'd have a lot in common."
She glares at them.
"So this was all a big play to damage Weyland-Yutani's stock price? Why?" "Come the end of the fiscal year, Seeks Incorporation will be a 5% shareholder," Helen says. "That'll get us a spot on the board. Symbiosis is the best way to survive, don't you think?"
"And think of the power differential when we approach them with an applied pharmacological usage of the sample you've brought us," Dan adds. Blue starts to speak, but Dan raises a hand. The prick actually interrupts her.
"We're here to offer you a choice, Dr. Marsalis. We don't believe your research is complete. We want you to continue with us, and we'll sustain you for as long as you need."
"To research a cure?"
"To design a cure is to control the sample," Helen replies. "We want a broad portfolio of applications before we approach the possibility of a merger."
Blue searches their faces, More of the same corporate stooges, just wearing different name tags. The problem with Dorian Sudler was that he wasn't one in a million. He was a promotable opportunist. He contained every trait Weyland-Yutani valued in an executive. Quick, cruel, creative, self-starter. He was brutally efficient, the type of man to obey a business model over a moral compass. Those were all skills required to make it in the modern workplace. Blue played chess with the devil. She knew his tricks, so Helen and Dan had no idea who they were fucking with. She'd design her cure, and they'd double-cross her, but she'd be two steps ahead by then. She couldn't be sure how they'd come at her, or what she'd use to respond. But she knew some things for certain. She was clever. She was powerful. She was unbreakable. After all, she'd been through the forge. This concludes the reading of Alien, The Cold Forge by Alex White. Trademark and copyright, 2018, by 20th Century Fox Film Corporation. This book was read by Michael Braun. This unabridged recording was produced in 2018. Neither this recording, nor any portion of it, may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Publishing. If you would like to obtain a monthly update telling you about new releases, call 1-800-SAY-BOOK. That's 1-800-729-2665. For a complete listing of our titles, visit our website at www.downpour.com. Thank you.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.